it's easier said than done, but try to stay calm. I think if you get hurt, take a step back and just say, okay, where am I? Or am I safe? Obviously I'm in pain or I'm hurt, but am I safe in the current scenario? If you're not, try to get to a safer spot.
The Life in Motion podcast is brought to you by Actual Outdoors. They help build beautiful brands that highlight the approachable and authentic parts of outdoor recreation. Said simply, they keep it real. Learn more at actualoutdoors.com.
This is a Life in Motion audio experience, a podcast about travel, action sports, culture, and more.
What's up, and welcome to episode 183 of Life in Motion. I've got Ashley with me from Lakes Region Search and Rescue. As the name suggests, they're a nonprofit search and rescue team that serves the White Mountains and Lake Region of New Hampshire. I'm excited to learn more about their important impact and maybe even some helpful tips for exploring the outdoors. Ashley, thanks for being on the show today.
Hey, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much.
Yes. I'm excited to have you on as well, especially, you know, a lot of our guests are obviously outdoor oriented, but more about the adventures. And, you know, this is a little bit of a different topic. So I think it's going to be really helpful and obviously an important topic as well. But before we kind of get into everything that you all do, how it started, et cetera, let's kind of start with, you know, your background story, kind of your story into the outdoors, you know, where you grew up, kind of what led you down this path in the first place?
Yeah, sure. So I was born and raised in New Hampshire. That's where we're based out of. As a little girl, my dad kind of introduced me to the mountains. I always had this love for being outside. And I can remember all of these great times of us just kind of going and doing the smaller mountains that are actually in the Lakes region. I have pictures of us together along with my sister. So I've kind of hiked my entire life. My journey into search and rescue wasn't until my adult years. And as I don't know if some of the listeners know, but there are 48 4,000 footers in New Hampshire. And like many people in New Hampshire, they started hiking a lot more during the pandemic. I had hiked some of the bigger mountains earlier in like the 2000s, but I never finished my 4,000 footer journey. And during the pandemic, I decided that, hey, I'm going to actually go ahead and try doing this. So I actually finished my 4,000 footers and I did most of them solo. And as anyone that has hiked knows, that you learn a lot as you hike in the White Mountains or hike in general. There's things that you learn as you grow through those mountains, and there's mistakes that you make, and there have actually been some mistakes that I have made myself. And after I finished my 48, I decided I'm going to get my wilderness first aid. And from there, I did that through SOLO, which is a medical school that's in New Hampshire. And I decided that from there I was going to do my first responder. So I went and did my first responder, and the instructor at the time, who's also now a friend, Chris BB, had introduced me to the idea of search and rescue. And so I talked to him a lot about search and rescue, and I decided, hey, you know, this is something that I'm really interested in. And I applied to the team. And then from there, the rest is history. What I didn't realize was that previously, before actually being introduced to search and rescue, there was this article that's called Emotional Rescue by Ty Gagne. He wrote it in the Appalachia. And it's about this rescue of this woman that was a hiker and was out hiking just on her downtime, but ended up rescuing someone in the White Mountains. And the story itself hit me so deeply because I've actually been in that position where I was scared and lost in the White Mountains. And I wanted to be that woman in this story that was actually rescuing someone. So it kind of all folded together as I went through this journey of hiking myself to then doing wilderness medicine to then learning about search and rescue and then pursuing that avenue myself. So that's kind of full circle of why I've gotten introduced into search and rescue.
Yeah, that's interesting. And definitely sounds like, you know, growing up a beautiful place to grow up and plenty to explore. And, you know, cool that you took all of it that it has to offer in that regard. And so you mentioned kind of as you were, you know, chasing your goals for, you know, doing the different climbs and everything and hikes, what were some of those, I guess, you mentioned the connection with the book or how that kind of created that connection, but I guess, what were some of those, mistakes that you mentioned that you did have, and then hindsight, which obviously, you know, kind of, propelled to kind of what you're doing now with search and rescue. But I guess, what are there any like examples of that, I guess, that you could share?
Yeah, I have actually two very strong stories that stick out in my mind of where I think I could have done something differently. So I was hiking, this was before I was on my 4,000 footer journey. So I wasn't as an experienced hiker as, you know, I was then and now. But I decided to go hiking in Cannon, which is one of the 4,000 footers. And I decided I was going to take a different trail that day. And I didn't pack, you know, I was in like cotton clothing. I didn't pack a map with me. I think my cell phone wasn't fully charged. I didn't have a navigational device. I didn't tell anyone where I was. I didn't bring enough water. It was a very hot day. I ended up summiting and then coming down, and I was tired. I think I fell a couple times, which once your mental state kind of changes when you're hiking, that's where there's that recipe of disaster, where if you're not in a strong mental mind frame, you kind of, it all kind of is a domino effect from there. So I remember when I was hiking up that there was a blue blaze. So I remember thinking in my head, okay, I want river, river blue. And I was heading down. I think at this point I had had some sort of heat exhaustion because I just wasn't thinking straight. My cell phone had died. And I remember just trying to find the trail back to my car and yelling for help. And there were actually people swimming in the river. And I must have seemed like a crazy person at the time because I was kind of crying. And I was like, hey, where am I? Where am I located? And they told me, and I'm like, I finally did get back to my car and everything was fine. Hindsight, you know, looking at that girl that I was then, you know, I definitely would have been like, okay, you should have definitely brought more water. You should have put your handkerchief that you had in the water in the cold river and put that on your neck. Definitely could have ate and drank a lot more. Definitely brought a map. Let someone know where you were, mapped out your destination beforehand. So like there were things that I definitely took away from it. And then the second example was actually, I went and started my hike and right off the gate, I took a wrong trail. And now when I kind of mess with that, I say, okay, is this how today is going to be? But I was determined to summit this mountain, and I was doing the Wildcats for our listeners, so they know what I was doing. And I ended up doing the Wildcat Ridge, which is one of the harder summits or harder trails in the White Mountains. And I was just struggling that day. I was having a hard time. I just was fatigued. And when I was coming down, I decided there was a turn and the trail kind of veered to the left, but I went right thinking that that's where the trail went. And mistake number one was I threw my trekking poles off the ledge. And when you don't have your trekking poles, you know, that's one of your stabilities. And it's also my gear, and you spend a lot of money on your gear. So yeah. I'm going to go after it. And so then I decided to go off that rock ledge and go get my trekking poles. And from there, I kind of slid down the ledge and I couldn't get back up. I got my trekking poles and I looked up and I was like, I can't scale this rock face. I'm definitely off trail. So at that point, I started yelling for help. Luckily there was a young gentleman that was hiking right up at the same time, and he was able to kind of reach down and pull me up. So at that point, you know, looking at that scenario, obviously I wasn't in a great mindset. I threw my gear into a space that I didn't know where that led. I didn't take a step back and just say, okay, orient myself. Where am I? Where am I trying to go? I didn't have a navigational device with me, so I wasn't tracking where I was going. And I probably hadn't drank or eaten enough any at that point as well. So I was not in a great mental state. So those are a couple of the examples where now as a rescuer, I know how those hikers are feeling because I personally have been in that situation. I mean, we're all human. Rescuers hike themselves, and it's all about risk assessment and little things that you can change throughout your hike to make sure that your hike goes more successfully. And without making those mistakes, I wouldn't be the hiker that I am today.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm definitely glad both of those stories worked out and, you know, some of your help there. And, you know, while you're, you know, while you're explaining that, you know, listening, you know, it sounds like simple thing. Oh yeah, you're hiking. Of course you should drink water, or you're doing this. Of course you should bring that. And they seem like simple things, but you know, when you're, and this is coming from not an experienced hiker as in myself, but you know, it seems like it's probably easy to overlook those seemingly simple things that are very important to continue that, that kind of journey and that adventure, that just kind of get overlooked for whatever reason. So, you know, it sounds like having that, that strong knowledge of a reminder, you know, for everybody, you know, to be able to have that right mental state, of course, so you can think, and everything as well. So you know, you had these personal experiences, of course. Then you read the book and had that connection, and, you know, I want to be the person that's helping that other person, which ultimately got you involved in the search and rescue. So I guess when you did get involved, what is that like, I guess, to, you know, obviously it's I don't know if it's volunteer based, and, you know, I know it's nonprofit and everything like that, but kind of what is the training or the things that kind of lead up to be able to, I guess, be part of the team, if that makes sense?
No, that's a good question. And I think a lot of people always wonder how you join search and rescue. So there are different organizations within New Hampshire. So there are 5 different teams within New Hampshire. So Lakes Region Search and Rescue is based out of the Lakes Region, as our name implies, but we also handle the Southern White Mountains, but that doesn't mean that that's fully our criteria. So there are different districts that we all kind of oversee. So we are District 2. But if there, in the instance that there's a call in another district, we will respond to that as well. So as far as joining Search and Rescue, we are fully volunteer. So everything that we do is volunteer. We are fully nonprofit as well. So everything that we receive as for donations goes back to the team. The process is you would apply. And then from there, based on your qualifications in your application, as well as your location. So when the team had first started in 2019, we were accepting applications kind of sort of all over the state. And then once our team kind of grew and we were in a better, you know, understanding of where our call outs were going to be, we sort of decided that you have to be within our district or town bordering our district to be able to apply, just for our call outs and being able to respond. From there, as a board, the board would review the application. If they say, yep, this person is someone that we'd like on the team, then you go ahead and you do a qualification hike. So what the team would do is we would hold qualification hikes. I believe we'd start them in March, sometimes March, mostly April, and we go April through September, sometimes into October. And we were holding one each month so that people that applied would be able to go through a qualification hike. And on a qualification hike, it's normally one member of the board. So our board of directors has 7 people. I'm actually on the board of directors. I'm the treasurer. So one of the board of directors, and then we also have a training committee. So we'd have people from the training committee attend that hike as well. And we would just hike with you. We do the same hike every time we do a qualification hike. And it's just assessing, how did you handle your layers? Did you hydrate? Did you bring proper fuel for your body? Did you have a navigation device? Were you layering, unlayering? And then just assessing just communication with the team, like, how, you know, we've seen a very broad range of people. So like, what's your background? Why are you interested in search and rescue? Things like that. And then from there, if we say everyone meets at the end of the hike, as far as like people on the team, and we discuss the qualifications, and then we decide whether or not we want to extend an offer to join the team.
Okay. So, and that's kind of what I thought, you know, kind of an extensive, you know, process in that regard, which obviously makes sense. And, you know, especially kind of during that hiking evaluation, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, the team that's going out there to, you know, help someone else is taking care of themselves during that search. So that's obviously super important. So you mentioned kind of, the area that your specific district covers. How many, and there's 7 board members, how many volunteers are typically within your team?
I think our roster right now is around, I think we have 70 plus volunteers right now.
Wow.
I think we're sitting around 75 volunteers. Every team is different. Some teams have a cutoff at a certain amount. We don't have a cutoff yet. So I think, we're around 70, 75.
Wow. Yeah. No, that also makes sense. I mean, there's, you know, depending on who's available when the actual emergency does arrive and arise and everything else like that. And it sounds very similar to, where I grew up was a very small town, not any mountains or anything like that, but it kind of reminds me a little bit as we had volunteer fire departments around. So I'm kind of equating that in a similar sense to that, which makes sense. And that's really, really cool kind of how that's built and kind of comes together. So how, I guess, and something that I don't really exactly know, so I guess that's why I'm asking this, is, you know, how does it work? You know, I guess, how long, or if someone goes missing, for say, is there a certain time period that usually you all, you know, get contacted within that? And then kind of what is that process look like as far as, you know, getting, you know, each, you know, team or the group of people that are going to do that? Like, what is that entire part look like? Because I mean, you know, like I said, it's a big space, a lot of woods, trees, all that good stuff. So yeah, I'm just curious there.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So I think it depends specifically. There are a lot of things that go into deciding who, like, what team is going to be called, and then like how many people are needed. So I'm actually also a dispatcher on our team, so I can go into how we dispatch a call. So let's just say, for example, let's use your example that someone was missing and they've been missing for, I don't know, like a day. It depends on like how much fish and game. So every call for search and rescue in New Hampshire is always dispatched from fish and game. So I'll go down the timeline. So what happens is someone calls 911 if there's like an overdue hiker, or if someone's hurt on a mountain, it always goes to 911 or state police. From there, it goes to fish and game. Fish and game then decides, is this something that they can handle, whether it be talking to that person on the phone and they can walk out on their own and helping direct them via phone, or are they going to have to dispatch teams? If they decide, okay, we're going to have to dispatch teams, then they look at the area, and then they look at, okay, this is in Lakes Region area, or this is in PEMI's call out area. Now, what gets kind of lines get crossed is, let's say that PEMI, which is another team, another search and rescue team, has already been on a call that day, or they're on a current call, but now there's another call in their district. Well, then the Lakes Region is going to get called because we work a lot with them. Same thing with like AFSAR, where if they're already on a call or there's not enough people, that's where there's going to be a multi-team call out. So what happens is then from there, Fish and Game will call me or our other dispatcher, John, and they'll explain to us the situation. So they'll say, there's a 70-year-old man with dementia. He's been missing or overdue since XYZ. They were last seen in this clothing. We're asking for all of the available volunteers. And then what we'll do is we use a system called One Call Now, and we'll dispatch a phone call with as much detail as we can. And then what will happen is that will call out the team. They'll respond if they can go or not. And then we use an app called WhatsApp, and we put in as much detail as we can in there. And then people start to respond in WhatsApp, their ETA. And then the last step is for us to let Fish and Game know how many people we're having respond. So in the example we're using, where it's a search, there's going to be more people that are going to go out. They need more people usually. or sometimes not. Sometimes they say we only need 5 people. It depends. But then we'll let Fish and Game know how many people that are going to be able to attend that call. So I think that the big thing that I want to stress about a call out is when someone needs help, it doesn't happen right away. So you have to think about, all right, if you get hurt at 1 p.m. and you make a call to 911 at 1:10, and then 911 has to then contact all of their resources into Fish and Game. So let's say it gets to Fish and Game 1:20, and then Fish and Game contacts us, and it takes us about 10 minutes to dispatch that. So we're at 1:30, 1:40, and then you're 2 hours outside of our district. So now we're looking at 3:40, and then you're 2 or 3 miles up trail. Well, that takes, let's say if you're going 2 miles an hour, that's about an hour and a half. So we're looking at about 4 hours in this example before you're even having help come see you. So it doesn't happen very quickly. It's going to take time because people have to, it has to go through the phone chain, but then also everyone has to get their gear ready, get drive to you, and then hike up to where you're at. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's not as easy, you know, as, you know, maybe some people thought, obviously, you know, that you know, a call comes in, hey, I'm hurt on the trail, here I am. It's not as easy as hopping a car, driving down the highway, and oh yeah, I'll be there in 30 minutes for sure, you know, because there's a little bit more to it in that regard. But you know, definitely it sounds like everything's very well thought out as far as, you know, the areas and working with the different organizations to make sure that everyone's you know, taken care of in that sense. So I guess what, you know, cause you've been working with them for how long now? You said around 2020?
I started on the team in 2021. So the spring of 2021.
Okay. Okay. Awesome. So like what is the most, you know, maybe the most common thing that you all see when you get called out for a search and rescue that, you know, might, as we mentioned kind of in the story, you know, it might kind of, when talking about it, seems obvious, but when you're actually in the action and doing it, maybe not so much. Are there any kind of like commonalities that you typically see that people can use to kind of like, I don't know, I guess, avoid from falling or finding themselves in that situation?
Yeah, I think I wish I could say like, this is exactly what you need to do and you will be fine. That is not the case. My team gets a lot of calls for like lower leg injuries. We do get a lot of like broken ankles or rolled ankles. I wish I could say like, hey, wear proper footing and you'll be fine. But a lot of the calls that we've gone on, they've been in hiking shoes. They've been in great shoes. I would say the one thing that when we do go to rescue people, the one thing that people don't have is a headlamp. So they don't have any way of like lighting the trail. Which I mean, it's not something that's gonna, it could save your life, but it's just one of the 10 essentials when we talk about hike safety, that you should have with you. We have seen a lot of negligent, or I've heard a lot of stories about negligent hikers. So, you know, not having proper clothing, not having, proper footwear, hydration, or even having hydration and not using their hydration. I mean, we think about that more when we're coming into the colder season. It's harder to drink water and eat, but that's when you're bringing in cold air to your body and then warming it up, you're actually burning more calories. So you have to think, okay, I need to be eating and drinking a lot more in the winter. And then I think a lot of it comes down to that idea of I need to summit. I need to see the top of this mountain. I need to get to the top. And instead of turning around and kind of that risk decision making isn't always the best. So those are the kind of the top things that I think of when we get searches. It's just people not making the right decisions for what's happening with the weather and or their gear. And then there are a lot of cases where people couldn't have prepared. You know, there are medical conditions that happen that you can't prepare for. You just don't know that they're going to happen. We think about heart attacks, there was a gentleman a couple years ago that actually had, I believe it was kidney stones or gallstones, and he had to be carried out. People, and then there are fatalities. There are some people that actually do pass away. We don't always, we're not always told what happened, but, you know, we have to go recover them. So there isn't, it's always just kind of using a skill set of like preparing for your height that can give you the best outcome.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. And, you know, I feel like there's so many, like kind of little nuggets in there that, you know, one, you know, breathing in cold air, burning more calories as your body turns that into warm air, and whatnot. So, you know, definitely that preparation sounds like, you know, one of the most, important things there. And I know we've kind of covered, you know, we talked about some stories and kind of the whole process and everything. But before we wrap things up, are there, is there anything else that I might've forgotten to ask that, that is important for others to hear or to share, I guess in regards to, search and rescue or the organization?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, like I said, I talked about it a little bit, is just when you go out to hike, you want to think about what am I hiking? What am I bringing? What does the weather look like? And it's not looking at, you know, AccuWeather or anything like that. It's looking at, there are multiple different apps that you can look at for mountain weather. Definitely looking at the Mount Washington Observatory to see what the higher summit report is going to be. Looking at what is the base temperature going to be in comparison to the summit temperature. Looking at trail reports and seeing what other people have reported for trail conditions, especially in the winter months, seeing, okay, do I need snowshoes? Do I need micro spikes? Okay, is there a lot of ice? Would I need crampons? Do I need to bring an ice axe? So like making sure that you kind of have all of the, your gear dialed in. And when we talk about gear as well, just because something works well for me, doesn't mean that's going to work great for you. So you have to kind of test out what is going to work for your body, because I have very specific layers and things that I like to wear, but they might not work for you. Making sure that you have food and water with you and that you're consuming those. We like to kind of have people use the Hike Safe card. It's actually a fish and game card. It helps you in the case that you do need to be rescued. And then the proceeds actually go towards fish and game and kind of funding the search and rescue portion of fish and game. And you can actually get those at hikesafe.com. They also list out kind of the essentials that they suggest to have with you when you are going out hiking. And then I'm trying to think, as far as, you know, great story, like good stories, you know, there's never a good story when someone has to be rescued. I can tell you of a rescue that I actually went on where it was an AT hiker. You know, she was coming southbound to northbound and a storm came in and she actually stepped on a rock and slipped and we had to go get her. Now, this is a woman that has hiked over 1,000 miles at this point. So I would say she's pretty, you know, an avid hiker, a very experienced hiker, and just happened to have a mishap where she lost her footing and we had to carry her out. And I actually emailed her because she had donated to us and she explained to me, she was from Australia and she thanked us so much for our kindness and just, you know, helping her through that and getting her out of the mountains and everything. And she actually ended up having to get surgery on her. So it wasn't a great story, but at the end of the day, like we did help her and she said she would be back in the White Mountains again at some point. So it was nice to have a connection with someone later on and to kind of hear what happened to them. So it was good for us that we were able to help her and she had that resource because she was an experienced hiker and she just happened to have an accident. So it's not always negligence. It is sometimes just what it is, an accident.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I'm sure as, you know, in her case, you know, being the avid hiker and whatnot and other people as well, you know, I'm sure there is some level of comfort there, you know, knowing that there are people there to help, such as, you know, your teams and whatnot, if an emergency does come up or something like that does happen. So no, I think that's great. And, you know, what, as you mentioned, you know, there's necessarily no good stories because, you know, nothing really good happened to get to that point. But hearing kind of, you know, the successes and being able to, you know, do, you know, serve people in that way, you know, essentially and keep them safe and getting them out of tough situations is really good. So and so kind of, you know, to that point, one piece of advice I always like to ask our guests is kind of or one question I always ask, like to ask our guests is one piece of advice that our listeners can take away. And, you know, that hike safeguard, you know, sounds like a very helpful thing. But for anybody, you know, whether, you know, it's in the mountains or maybe it's flat terrain somewhere or whatever, what would your, like, you know, maybe they find themselves in a situation where they do get injured on the trail or wherever they're at in the outdoors and there's no one around and they're waiting for somebody or, you know, anything like that, as far as to get help, what is like the biggest thing that individual should be thinking about, or I guess focusing on to kind of stay, within that mental state that you mentioned, at the beginning of the episode to kind of help keep them calm as they're waiting for, you know, these things to develop as far as dispatching and the team coming and locating and everything like that. Is there like a, I guess like a top level thing that's really important that would maybe help people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess what comes to mind for me is it's easier said than done, but try to stay calm. I think if you get hurt, take a step back and just say, okay, where am I? Or am I safe? Obviously I'm in pain or I'm hurt, but am I safe in the current scenario? If you're not, try to get to a safe, get to a safer spot. And then from there, it's say, get off the ground. And what I mean by that is, regardless if it's summer or if it's winter, make sure that there's something between you and the ground. Don't be sitting on the ground because you lose a lot of your body heat between you and the ground. The ground could be wet. There could be snow. There could be a root, and anything. Just try to make sure there's protection between you and the ground. And then from there, you know, if you're bleeding, can you stop the bleeding? And then try to think outside the box. And we talk a lot about this when you go through your wilderness first aid course, is what do you have in your pack that you can utilize as something that would help you? Because when you're in backcountry and you're doing backcountry first aid, there are a lot of things in your backpack that you can use as like multi-tools. So like if you have a handkerchief, you could use that as like a splint or a wrap or a tourniquet. If you don't have gloves, if you have a sandwich bag, you can use your sandwich bag as like a barrier between you and any bodily fluids. Baseball caps can be used as a neck brace or a splint in some cases. So it's just like thinking of other things in your backpack that you might be able to use to help yourself, and then try to stay calm and try to think of how can I, you know, contact help. If you're with a group, make sure that someone stays with the injured person, and then another person goes and gets help. Like always do the buddy system. And then if you are deciding that you're going to be a solo hiker, and you know, I am a solo hiker myself, just making sure that someone knows where you are and that you have a turnaround point or like a check-in point. I'm a huge advocate of the Garmin inReaches because you can actually use a satellite and message someone that you're hurt. I actually used it yesterday myself. I had a turnaround on a hike myself yesterday, and I knew that my friend Jen was watching my Garmin, and I sent her a message on it because I didn't have cell service. And I said, I'm turning around. I'm okay. I'll message you when I get cell service, just so she knew that I was turning around. I wasn't injured. So like making sure that you have another way of contacting people and not always relying on cell phone service.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think all those are excellent pieces of advice, you know, for everybody to think about. Hopefully they don't find themselves in that type of situation, but if they do, you know, to be able to think about those things. So to that point, where can people find you all online? You know, maybe they're interested in volunteering or seeing what other resources are out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So for our website is www.lrsar.org, or we're on Instagram at Lakes Region SAR. So those are a couple of places that you could find us.
Awesome. Well, definitely everybody, make sure you check them out. And then, you know, if you're an avid hiker or getting into it, you know, brush up on some of the safety things that we discussed. You know, there's plenty of things that I have never thought about it. As I said, I'm not an avid hiker myself, and or I guess to that extreme. But you mentioned some good tips in there that, you know, kind of made me think like, oh yeah, that makes sense. A sandwich bag, or, you know, getting off the ground. Those kind of seemingly simple things, as I mentioned, but definitely make sure you stay up to date with that. But anyways, I appreciate you coming on to share your story, and I appreciate all that you do for the community and to support you know, others when they find themselves in that situation. And I wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. And hey, if you've made it this far and like what you've heard, go ahead and hit that subscribe button and let your friends know about Life in Motion. Until next time.